Welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, your daily podcast of the top education headlines from across the web. And now, here are your hosts, Mike and Susie.
Good morning and welcome to the K-12 Breakdown with Brooks and Bronder, where we read out the news so you don't have to. We have some great stories today for you, and I am Mike Bronder with my co-host, Ms. Susie Brooks.
Good morning, Michael, and happy spring. It's the first day of spring today.
Thank goodness for it, Susie. Not a moment too soon. We have some great stories that we're going to go in depth on today, including teachers increasing student engagement by creating their own videos. We have another story on data privacy, cybersecurity, and comments on the COPPA rules. And let's see, over 80% of women leaders in education are experiencing bias, survey shows, and that's brought to us by Linda Jacobson and the 74. And then finally, a Missouri high school program goes farm to table. But let's kick it off with Susie Brooks. What's coming across your desk this morning, Susie?
Okay, well, we're looking at the fact that there is an eclipse coming up, and we've seen quite a few stories ranging from stay away and cancel school. But this one is coming at us from eSchool News, written by David Vernier, and it's 7 tips and ideas to make the eclipse engaging for students. So you can check that out, and they'll give you some ways that you can make it engaging because there's a total solar eclipse that'll be visible over the United States starting in Texas. And then you can move on to another story that's coming out of eSchool News by Ben Talsma, four keys to unlock student curiosity and critical thinking. As an educator, I've always been fascinated by my students' innate curiosity. So from an early age, they've had an insatiable desire to learn. So you can go ahead and check that out, article out also on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And I'm going to dive into one this morning, also on engagement, a very favorite topic of mine. And this one is called Teachers Are Increasing Student Engagement by Creating Their Own Videos. It's on the 74. And it's funny, we go to the 74 a lot. Mike and I were talking about that earlier today. It's just a favorite source of ours, and they come out with a lot of great content. And it goes on to say, EdTech advocates encourage educators to form bonds with their classes by creating bite-sized videos similar to TikTok content. It's written by Sierra Lyons. Despite many challenges of virtual learning, many teachers are leveraging technology to increase engagement and build rapport with students. Some virtual and in-person educators find non-traditional learning formats even more successful in keeping students interested than face-to-face instruction. Lindy Hockenberry is the author of A Teacher's Guide to Online Learning and an instructional technologist who helps educators and schools learn how to better use technology. A large part of Hockenberry's work is finding new ways for students to feel connected in to their teachers so that engagement and learning can occur. One strategy Hockenberry encourages is instructor-created videos. A 2014 study found that instructor-generated video content improved overall student engagement and satisfaction in higher ed online courses. Both the number and depth of responses for student discussions increased when teachers incorporated videos they created themselves. Jennifer Lewandowski, head of marketing for ClassIn, an edtech company for digital learning, says that as a society and culture change, so does education. As TikTok has popularized shorter, less formal videos, Lewandowski and Hockenberry encourage teachers to follow suit. They believe that while more professional videos from platforms like Khan Academy are beneficial for students, more casual and personal videos from teachers can create a deeper sense of connection. Hockenberry cites research that found students feel a greater bond with their teacher when teachers incorporate videos that they created themselves than in classes where instructor-produced content wasn't used. ClassIn allows teachers to record and edit videos, as well as create virtual worksheets, create polls, take attendance, offer interactive Blackboard, give out quizzes, and grade assignments. I think that meeting students where they are has always been super important, Levandusky says. And right now, where students are is they're digesting so much bite-sized video content across platforms. If you can use some of that video content to almost establish a parasocial relationship with your students, that is another way to help you feel connected to them. Hockenberry says that teachers can create videos for a variety of purposes, including introducing themselves to their class at the start of the year, explaining lessons, going over the syllabus, and providing one-on-one feedback to students. She says she encourages teachers to not worry if they stumble over their words a bit while they are recording, because when they are lecturing face-to-face, they wouldn't restart if they mess up. During a class-in webinar on January 22nd, moderated by Levandusky, Hockenberry discussed strategies for increasing student engagement in remote, hybrid, and in-person classes. Hockenberry noted that engagement is determined by whether students feel like they belong and will be successful in completing assignments. That's why teachers need to foster a sense of personal relationship and community in their classrooms, she notes, whether it's face-to-face or virtual. Though nearly all schools have gone back to in-person instruction, Hockenberry says classroom technology is more relevant than ever. She believes the only way schools are going to increase student engagement is if teachers use a blended format that includes lecturing face-to-face, creating videos or podcasts, and using other forms of technology so that learning and engagement can come in multiple forms. Another way of technology can be useful in boosting students' interests is by letting those who may be less inclined to speak in class due to social anxiety or being naturally introverted to participate. Levandusky says a student may never raise their hand in class, but may chat online or contribute in other nonverbal ways. Hockenberry says technology can also enable students to give teachers feedback anonymously. Everybody gets to input versus if you're doing it in a lecture environment, Hockenberry says. You may only have time to call on one or two students, and it's not going to be the ones that are shy. I think that's a great article, and it makes me think about the professional learning courses that I teach teachers. I've always told them that video you is way cooler than you. And your students, they always laugh at that too, that students will listen to a video of you teaching a concept way more intently than they will listen to the same exact content of you standing in front of them. And it's like having an extra teacher in the room. You're kind of spinning the classroom. I know that they talk a lot about flipped classroom, but it's more like spinning the classroom. You're on the screen teaching the content you would have taught anyway. Your students are actually listening to it, and it frees you up to move around the classroom, to observe what they're doing, to be able to touch base with individual students or help them individually in ways that you can't do when you're standing in front of the students, or they can listen to them individually on video. It's such a nice way to be able to engage your students. So that's why that article stuck right out to me. But if you want to be able to check it out yourself again or share it out with friends, you can head over to k12leaders.com/breakdown.
Susie, that's fascinating. And it's almost like you're magnifying yourself or duplicating yourself, or
Yes.
that's really cool.
Yeah.
I had not heard that before, and I think that's a great article. Thanks for sharing.
You're welcome. What do you got?
So elsewhere in the headlines, let's see. Only a quarter of federally funded education innovations benefited students, a report says. The Hechinger report dives in deep on this. Under the Investigating Innovation Program, or I3, the federal government gave out $1.4 billion between 2010 and 2016 to education nonprofits and researchers for the purpose of developing and testing new ideas in the classroom. But only 26% of the innovations yielded any positive benefits. You can find that link to that article on k12leaders.com/breakdown. And the question I would pose to you for discussion is 26% more or less than you would expect out of innovative programs? You can discuss that here on K12 Leaders. Let's see, another article, this one coming from the 74 again, and Beth Fertig. The six tips for spotting a high school that best prepares teens for the future. And Beth goes into some of those details on this article that we have linked to the 74. And we will go into depth here on a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I've had a number of conversations here on K-12 Leaders over the past several months about farm to table, or farm to school. And this was originally reported in the New York Times, and we have our take on it here. A Missouri high school program goes farm to table. And this was originally reported by Mark Josephson, Josephus, Josephson, Josephson, Mark Josephson of the New York Times. At Maysville High School in rural Missouri, an hour's drive north of Kansas City, some classes can be a bit tough for the squeamish. Located in a town of just 1,100 people, the high school offers a unique vocational program that takes students through the entire farm-to-table process of harvesting livestock and cooking with the resulting meat. And this is interesting because many farm-to-table or farm-to-school programs are based primarily on vegetables. It all starts in the school's agricultural classes, where students learn how to ethically cull animal like deer, rabbits, and chickens. On a crisp December morning, agricultural teacher Brandy Ellis leads a group into an outbuilding where seven aggressive roosters were recently donated by a local resident. "All right, guys, we'll go through the steps like we practiced with the broilers last month. Keegan, you're up first." Keegan Reeder, a sophomore wearing a bright blue Buffalo Bills hoodie, grabs one of the roosters and quickly wrings its neck in one smooth motion. "I've honestly never done this before," he admits, "but it's weirdly satisfying knowing the food on our plate will soon won't be factory farmed." The bird is then passed to other students, who deftly defeather it by dunking the carcass into a vat of boiling water. This messy work is far outside the comfort zone of typical high school fare. But as Ellis explains, learning how to harvest renewable natural food sources is an increasingly vital skill in an era of rising grocery costs and strained supply chains. Later that day, the culled roosters are brought into the agricultural building for the next step, butchering and processing. Freshman students move from station to station, breaking down the carcasses, saving parts like organs for future dissections in science classes. Sophia Redmond, a 14-year-old making her first cut into a hanging deer, wrinkles her nose but presses on. "It's kind of gross looking," she grimaces, "but I know it will be worth it to get to eat it in the end. My dad hunts deer too, so I've seen this before." For many Maysville students, experiences like hunting and butchering are a normal part of life in this rural community. Deer hunting, in particular, is a popular local tradition, an affordable way to supplement grocery shopping with 60 to 70 pounds of free-range organic meat from a single animal. As senior Garrett Bray puts it, "The permit costs practically nothing compared to getting that much quality meat from the store. My family has been doing this for generations." The final and most delicious part of Maysville's farm-to-table program happens in family and consumer science teacher Amy Kanick's classroom kitchen. It's here that students get to prepare meals using the very meat they procured, butchered, and broke down in other classes. On a February afternoon, an intoxicating aroma of sizzling chicken livers wafts through the air as Kanick students fry up the remains of the roosters they culled weeks earlier. And a personal note here, I have to say that not everybody thinks the aroma of chicken livers is intoxicating, but growing up with my grandmother and the chicken livers that she would cook up on Saturday evenings, it makes my mouth water, so excuse me. Cameron Kieseman passes around a plate to sample their handiwork. "I've honestly never tried chicken liver before, but this is amazing. Crispy on the outside, nice and tender inside." Dishes like these provide a clear payoff from all the hard work earlier in the process. For their final exam, Kanick's pupils will prepare an entire venison feast: chicken fried deer steaks, fried potatoes and gravy, green beans, and more. It's an impressive spread that puts their new farm-to-table skills on full display. "My goal for students is to really understand where their food comes from," Kanick explains, "not just see it prepackaged from the grocery store, but appreciate the hard work and ethics involved in responsibly harvesting and using every part of an animal." Colton Lemunyan, a senior rocking a Metallica t-shirt, savors a crispy fried chicken drumstick, one of the tougher roosters culled that morning for being overly aggressive. "Man, you can really taste the difference with this fresh natural chicken, and you get a sense of pride too, putting the work in yourself to catch and prepare it." For students raised in this rural hunting community, that sense of hands-on pride is nothing new when it comes to providing food for the table. But Maysville Vocational Program provides structure, safety, and science to codify those crucial life skills. As junior Robert Boucher puts it, "My grandparents grew up on farms, but nowadays most kids are so far removed from where their food actually comes from." This class makes that connection again. Whether students pursue future careers in butchery, food service, agriculture, or elsewhere, they'll graduate with a rare level of self-sufficiency and connection to their food sources. Cooper Ray, another senior, sums it up. "I'll never mindlessly bite into a grocery store burger again after going through this whole process. Excuse me. Who knows? I may even take up hunting and butchering for myself after learning how to do it all properly here." In a modern era where most Americans are completely disconnected from food production, Maysville High School is charting its own path, one that reclaims the agricultural heritage of local communities while teaching important vocational skills for tomorrow. As agriculture teacher Brandy Ellis sums it up, "Our kids get out of the classroom and into the real world in a very literal way with this program." So that is, or you can find the link to that original story in k12leaders.com/breakdown. And thanks, Mark Josephson from the New York Times, for bringing that to our attention. So much of that resonates with me, Susie. Thanks for bearing with me as we went through that very vivid description of that farm-to-table program. And I think you're muted.
You're right, I was, and hungry. That's awesome. Thanks for sharing. Looking at our feed, and one of the titles that sticks out to me is "Are Super Strict Schools Good for Students?" Did you read that one out earlier?
I have not. That's
No,
is from
that's
the
one that's come the
Learning
Learning
Network again.
Network. Yeah,
Yeah.
it makes me want to read it. I have not yet, though. I must have been that I read it earlier. Supporters say that they help children succeed. Critics say that they are oppressive. And what do you think? So that one's coming from the Learning Network. So it always invites you to weigh in. There's an opinion piece that's coming from Manny Diaz on the 74 that's talking about Florida's education system is proof that accountability works. So it'd be interesting to see where people would weigh in on that one. When Florida Governor Ron DeSantis took office in 2019, he knew parents, families, and educators were concerned about the Common Core. The then 9-year-old education initiative was supposed to improve achievement by creating academic standards for K-12 students across dozens of states. Instead, an era of rigid test taking, confusing, crazy math learning strategies, and one size fit all instruction ensued. So I have to see where your opinion comes in on that article. And another one coming out of the 74 from Michael Petrilli is "Improving Our Schools: How Have Standards-Based Reforms Succeeded and Failed?" So it almost is a similar article, it seems like. The 74 is partnering with the Stanford University's Hoover Institute to commemorate the 40th anniversary of a Nation at Risk report. Hoover's A Nation at Risk Plus 40 research initiative spotlights insights and analysis from experts, educators, and policymakers as to what evidence shows about the broader impact of 40 years of education reform. So those are some that you can check out. And I'm going to take a deeper dive on some data privacy, cybersecurity, lead comments on COPPA rule proposal. So this one is coming out of K-12 Dive. And it talks about how some commenters, oh, excuse me, commenters, commenters, yes. Oh my goodness, called for more alignment to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act and the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. And this is written by Anna Murad, and it came out yesterday. There were 730 public comments submitted to the Federal Register regarding the Federal Trade Commission's proposed regulation changes to the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA rule. The proposal announced in December would place new guardrails on a company's ability to profit from using children's personal data. Feedback provided during the open comment period, which closed March 11, included support among individual parents and the National Association of Attorneys General, as well as calls from information and technology industry leaders to adjust parts of the proposal. Of the FTC proposal's potential impact on K-12 and EdTech, global nonprofit Future of Privacy Forum publicly commented that the FTC should work with the U.S. Department of Education to establish and maintain joint guidance of how EdTech companies and schools should navigate and align COPPA and the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act. So diving a little deeper, a wide range of comments on the suggested updates to the COPPA rule comes as more school leaders and lawmakers aim to take on technology and social media companies' impact on student mental health. At the same time, protecting student data privacy is also a district priority, with sensitive data collected by schools becoming increasingly vulnerable to data breaches and cyber attacks. COPPA is a federal law that gives parents control over what data websites can gather from their children under 13 years of age. While the COPPA rule is a regulation that enforces the placement of additional protections and establishes other procedures that these companies must follow, some of the FTC's proposed changes would still allow EdTech providers to collect, use, and disclose students' data with a school or school district's authorization, as long as it's for permitted school purposes and not for commercial use. The proposed rule would also strengthen COPPA's data security requirements. If finalized, the rule would implement further limitations on retaining data and would prohibit operators from using children's information for secondary purposes or keeping the data indefinitely. Parents would also have to give their verifiable consent to online service providers before companies could use data for targeting advertising to third parties. Given that there hasn't been an update to the COPPA rule since 2013, the National Association of Attorneys General encouraged the FTC to update the rule to keep pace and give state attorneys general the tools that they need to respond to a digital world rife with risk. In a public comment submitted by the Information Technology Industry Council, the advocacy group for the high-tech sector said that the retention of children's data in an educational context should be determined by the school instead of an EdTech vendor. Meanwhile, momentum is growing in Congress for the Kids Online Safety Act, a bipartisan bill that would require social media platforms to enable the strongest privacy settings for children by default. The bill would also give parents more tools on platforms to see and control privacy and account settings, which would automatically turn on for children under 13 and would be optional for teens ages 13 to 16. Similar to COPPA, the bill focuses on placing safeguards for children younger than 13. The bill would also ensure independent audits and research examining how social media companies are impacting the well-being of children and teens. Over 60 senators currently support the bill. By February, a bipartisan group of senators also reintroduced and co-sponsored an updated version of a COPPA 2.0 bill, which would ban targeted advertising to kids and teens and require companies to give parents and children the ability to delete information. It's funny, the article mentions and I'm not going to be able to roll it off the tongue because I wanted to, but it mentions the, there was a course that I took by, the Future of Privacy Forum that it mentions in here. And I took a course by them and it was over a year. Well, I would say it was probably a 10-month course. It was the hardest course that I've ever taken in my entire life, because it talks about all of the facets that it comes to when it's when you're talking about student data privacy. And as soon as you start to think that you know it and you understand it, you realize that there's so much more to learn and understand. And then when it comes time to start to teach others, which is what my role here is at school, It's very hard to do so because it's always changing and it's just so multifaceted. So trying to keep up with these articles is something that I try to do on a regular basis. So that was the reason that I chose this one today.
Sure.
And
Yeah, and Susie, we come across it all the time. It's like FERPA has been the law of the land for so long and is relatively straightforward compared to so many of these, cybersecurity concerns, but still people don't quite get it.
Very
And
true.
it's like when you dive down into the fundamentals and the reasons for all of these regulations, you get a certain level of appreciation that's hard to keep like first and foremost in mind when you have to like make sure kids are getting from one class to another.
Very true. All
So,
right, you have a few more, I think.
yeah, but thank you for that readout, Susie. Let's see. We have from Minnesota Public Radio, after 20 years of shrinking enrollments, Minneapolis and St. Paul schools are facing a reckoning. The Minneapolis district has seen enrollment drop by nearly 20,000 students since 2001, and St. Paul by just about 5,000 students. That is bringing a lot of hard questions to the fore in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and you can hear more about that, read more about that at Minnesota Public Radio, and you can find that link here on k12leaders.com/breakdown. Also, Tech and Learning breaks down three useful AI research tools for educators. That's on Tech and Learning. And let's see, we have an AI-enabled personal and professional learning microgrant announced, targets teachers and coaches for K to six. That's by eSchool News, and that's out of North Carolina and Core Insights, QORE Insights. Announced the launch for that micro grant. So you can find that link on eSchool News or k12leaders.com. And finally, we have a story from the 74 again. And let's see, that is by Linda Jacobson. Over 80% of women leaders in education experience bias. And this is survey results that the 74 has the exclusive on. At 5 feet tall, UNTU doesn't tower over anyone, including many students. So when a superior said she was too petite to be anything but an elementary school principal, she figured he was probably right. I accepted it because I didn't know any better, said Tiu, who didn't find encouragement from her own Vietnamese family either. My father was like, "Oh, I'm so surprised they selected you to be the principal." A decade later, Tiu has not only been an assistant principal and principal, she is now in charge of student support services for the Houston Independent School District, the eighth largest school system in the U.S. But as an Asian woman and a single mother, she still feels pressure to prove herself in a male-dominated field. I spend double time to make sure that everything I produce is 100%, nothing less, she said. The new survey from Women Leading Ed gave UNTU, who is in charge of student support services, a chance to discuss how she's experienced gender bias in her career. The comment about Tiu's height and job prospects is among the anecdotes district and state leaders shared as part of its first-of-a-kind survey of women serving in high-level school positions. Women Leading Ed, a 300-member national network, show that that despite ascending to senior roles in school systems and state departments, the vast majority of female leaders experience bias and think often about quitting. Over 80% of the 110 women who responded from 27 states said they feel they have to watch how they dress, speak, and act because they are in the spotlight as senior leaders. I have found myself in high-powered meetings where men in leadership roles do not even look at me, but instead address my male colleagues, said Angelica Infante Green, Rhode Island Education Commissioner and a Women Leading Ed board member. In a world where traditional notions of leadership have been predominantly shaped by men, there exists a profound need for diversity and representation. Infante Green visited a robotics lab at the Cranston Area Career and Technology Center last year, and one expert said, It comes a time when districts could benefit from strengths many women bring to the table. Women who come up through this pipeline have often been elementary school principals, and that sometimes precludes them from being selected as superintendents, said Rachel White, a University of Tennessee Knoxville assistant professor. She launched the Superintendent Lab, a research center, last summer to improve data collection on school system leaders. It's common, she said, for school boards to view high school principals, who are predominantly men, as more authoritarian or to prefer someone with a background in finance. The type of leadership we need right now around family and student engagement and curriculum and instruction, elementary school principals really need to get that right. But many women leaders say they face a double standard. When a man in leadership takes time to coach his child's sports team, he is applauded, Infante Green said. If I choose to attend my daughter's dance recitals over a meeting, I am judged much differently. Black, Hispanic, and Asian women in leadership positions feel even more pressure to watch how they dress, act, and behave. One said, I have been told to smile more, to stand a certain way, and received comments about the way I should wear my hair. Another leader quoted in the report said she was told to wear a skirt instead of pants to a presentation so she didn't come off as intimidating. Black, Hispanic, and Asian American women were even more likely to feel pressure related to their behavior, 55% compared with 36% for white women. One Black leader's colleagues said that the way she greeted students with "What's up?" made them uncomfortable because she was speaking Ebonics. Two, back in Houston, said students are often surprised to see a minority woman, especially an Asian American woman, in leadership. I want to show these young ladies that there's nothing wrong with having aspirations, she said. There are going to be moments in time when you have to overcome barriers, be smart, and learn from it. The survey results build on the superintendent research projects conducted by ILO Group, a woman-owned firm focused on education policy and leadership. Nationally, over 20% of the nation's 500 largest school districts saw turnover at the top, according to 2023 results. Among women, the rate was a little bit higher, 26%. The most recent analysis also showed that even with a modest increase in the number of appointed to superintendent positions, women still represent less than a third of those leading school districts. Women, however, make up 80% of the teacher workforce and more than half of the school principals. I really feel like the only potential way to move ahead in that district was to be part of the good old boys club, one superintendent said. If you didn't go to school there, play on the football team, and come up through the ranks, there was really no chance you would progress. That became clear in 2017 when Lauren Widmer, when she was in line for an assistant principal job. The district offered her a 9 a.m. interview on a Friday, the same morning she was scheduled to have a C-section. She asked for an alternative time, even a virtual interview at noon the same day of her son's birth, but the official turned her down. The position later went to a man. Among all these men, let's see, the new survey follows a recent thread that Raphael Baer initiated on LinkedIn, asking women leaders to share some of the worst comments they've heard along their professional journey. Some of the nation's top education leaders weighed in. A colleague said in front of the others, "You must be really proud to be the only woman among all these men," and then squeezed my shoulder a little longer than anyone needed, recalled Caroline Quintana, a deputy chancellor for the New York City schools. Leslie Muldoon, executive director of the National Assessment Governing Board, which oversees the National Assessment of Educational Progress, shared a comment she heard as a new mom. An older male colleague bitterly complained he wished he'd gotten a 3 month vacation after I got back from a horrible, miserable, painful maternity leave, she wrote. And Daylene Long, CEO of a STEM education company, posted that someone told her, being competitive is not an attractive trait in a woman. But some leaders also see signs of progress. In Afton, Widmer's district, half of the top level staff of four and of, I'm sorry, in Afton, Widmer's district, half of the top level staff and four of the five principals are women. She thinks the support women feel contributes to the district's stability. You don't have to choose between staying home with your sick kids or leading a department, Widmer said. You can do both. In 2020, Rhode Island Education Commissioner Infante Green participated in a daily COVID briefings within, I'm sorry, that's just citing a picture that's not in this article. And in the early months of the pandemic, Infante Green participated in daily press briefings with then Governor Gina Raimondo and Dr. Nicole Alexander Scott, the former state health director. A mother even sent the commissioner a card with Superwoman on it as thank you for inspiring her daughter. In that moment, it dawned on me that our presence together at those news conferences was more than just symbolic. It was a powerful statement of solidarity and resilience, she said. It sent a positive message that in Rhode Island, leadership knows no gender boundaries. So again, that was from the 74 and a survey summarizing survey results, and that was by Linda Jacobson. So thank you for that. And Susie, back to you.
Yeah, I bet that they could find stories that would go on and on in that thread for sure. Thank you for sharing. All right, I think that wraps us up. It's nice to be back this morning, and it was nice to start the day with you, Michael. To our Books and Bronder listeners, happy spring when flowers bloom and allergies attack and teachers contemplate a career change. Until next time, stay pollen-free and caffeinated. We hope you have a great day at school. I'm Susie Brooks, and
I'm Mike Bronder. Have a great day, everybody.